This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire Republicans are up in arms about the first Fox News GOP debate in the fall. Fox and CNN have both announced plans to winnow the crowded field down to just 10 candidates based on who's on top in national polls rather than those leading in early states. As the local GOP stews about the decision, we're going to visit some zingers in the largely unguarded theater of the political debate, like these.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
You know who voted for it? Might never know. That one. You know who voted against it? Me.
And they brought us whole binders full of women.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit my opponent's youth and inexperience.
NHPR reporter, host, and resident historian of presidential oddities, Brady Carlson, is with us. Brady, great to have you with us.
Hi there.
Have there always been presidential debates?
No, it's a relatively new thing. We sort of harken back to the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the Illinois U.S. Senate election of 1858. On the presidential level, the Kennedy-Nixon debates were the first, and certainly the first televised debates, but it was not a normal thing. And in fact, even after Nixon-Kennedy, it was not a normal thing. Richard Nixon did not debate in 1968. When he ran again for the presidency. He did not debate when he was running for re-election in 1972. It wasn't until Ford and Carter in the 1976 election that you started to see debates become a regular part of the election cycle.
But they've become a huge feature of elections. I'm thinking of the 1960 debate between Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy, that first televised debate. Huge news, but did that set the bar too high and expectations too high?
Well, it certainly set a kind of standard that you're going to have this very formal. I mean, the mechanics of the general election debates often tend to have that same style of the two candidates, the Republican and the Democrat, standing at podiums answering questions from a moderator. I mean, what's happened over the years in the same way that television as a whole has changed, debates have changed in that you're trying to score both on visual points, you're trying to look presidential, or you're trying to look like a strong candidate if you're running for a different office, and you're also trying to hit with that quick television moment. We had the zingers right at the beginning of this conversation. You're trying to score that moment, and that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with policy positions or you're standing on a particular issue. It's simply about what is the one thing that someone is going to take away from this event as a television program. That's kind of what it's turned into.
Right. That question of inclusion, which has come up here in New Hampshire recently, I mean, the fringer candidates do not always get included, do they? Is there any precedent for that?
What tends to happen in the primary debate process is that it's not always been managed by any one entity. It would be a consortium of news organizations, maybe a political party, maybe the League of Women Voters, kind of a hodgepodge of different groups and organizations, and they would make their own criteria. And there's always going to be somebody who takes issue with those criteria. And so you will see debates that will have 10 candidates in them. You might see some that have only four or five. And that has come up over the years. That came up, in fact, in 1968, there were a number of Democrats who were running to succeed Lyndon Johnson. And only a handful of them were part of the one debate that took place in California. It was Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. You didn't see Hubert Humphrey, who was also in the running. George McGovern had talked. In those days, the primary process was not as well defined in the same way that the debate process was not as well defined. Most candidates were trying to secure support at the convention, which was where the actual nomination was made, not through the primary process of winning votes and winning delegates in state primaries and in caucuses. In New Hampshire, the debate over which candidates should be allowed into a debate really came to a head in 1980. And there's the famous moment in the Republican debate. This is sort of a complicated story, but the long and the short of it was because of arguments between the campaigns about who should be included, whether it should just be Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California, and George H.W. Bush, or whether it should be the broader field that included a whole number of Republican hopefuls, Ronald Reagan ended up paying for the debate himself and including all of the candidates. What happened was that there was a continued argument about who should be up on the stage and who should not. And Reagan got into a debate with the moderator, who he called Mr. Green. Mr. Breen was his name, of the Nashua Telegraph. And they really got into it.
Let's hear a clip from that. This is from 1980.
Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off? Is this on? Mr. Green,
did you turn that microphone?
You asked for me if you would. I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green.
But that's a real moment. I mean, something is really happening there. It's memorable and quotable. Is that what candidates are trying to deliver? You know, the soundbite that everyone will remember them for?
They're trying to present a moment that will, in a way, encapsulate who they're trying to present themselves at. And for the supporters of Ronald Reagan in 1980, they said, here's a guy who was directly confronted with some opposition, and he took charge. They said, that's what you need in a president of the United States. And they saw that as a big turning point for him, trying to fend off what was then his chief primary opponent, George H.W. Bush, and winning the New Hampshire primary and eventually the Republican nomination for president.
Speaking of zingers, we did hear the where's the beef comment from Walter Mondale to Gary Hart in 1984. Now, here's the one that won quite a few over to John McCain.
In case you missed it, a few days ago, Senator Clinton tried to spend $1 million on the Woodstock Concert Museum. Now, my friends, I wasn't there. I'm sure it was a cultural and pharmaceutical event. I was tied up at the time, but the fact is.
And you hear the roar from the crowd because he was literally tied up at the time. So that sort of generational conflict between the people who were fighting in Vietnam, or in McCain's case, is a prisoner of war at that moment. And he's sort of characterizing Hillary Clinton and the Democrats as the peaceniks and the hippies just hanging out and taking drugs.
But that also gave John McCain a sense of humor. You know, it is through the long line of a political campaign, there are policy speeches, there are positions, there are platforms that are taken on things. But I feel like that was one of the things that was more memorable about John McCain's campaign. Is that true?
Increasingly, candidates want to present themselves not simply as in command of the facts and strong leaders, but also very relatable, very likable. Again, to use the analogy that presidential debates have become TV programs, you want to be a likable character. You want to be the one character, that the breakout character that everybody relates to, that everybody likes, that everybody tweets about. They like what you say. They like the way that you say it. They like how you look, and they like what they think you stand for.
Well, here's one of Joe Biden's 2008 breakout moments.
Rudy Giuliani, there's only three things he mentioned in a sentence: a noun and a verb and 9/11. I mean, there's nothing else. There's nothing else. And I mean it sincerely.
He kind of hit it out of the park with that one.
That's one, and you know that because you hear that to this day. When you hear Democrats responding to something that Rudy Giuliani said, even here in 2015, they will almost always refer to that Joe Biden quote when they make that reaction.
Well, sometimes the zingers don't quite land as intended. Let's hear just a little montage here of epic fails.
I'll tell you what. $10,000? $10,000 bet?
I'm not in the betting business, but okay.
I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank
Hillary,
you so much.
You know, lifting whole passages from someone else's speeches is not change you can believe in. It's change you can Xerox. And
well,
I just don't think.
No,
but, you know, but Barack, it is. Because if, you know.
Some memorable lines there.
Not everybody can pull off a good zinger. And, you know, whether that really tells you much about whether a person would be a good president of the United States or not, that has become sort of the moment that at least the national media points to and says, well, that line didn't land
How about the role that the media plays here? I mean, if we're trying to keep things above board and really about the issues, what role is the debate moderator and the questions playing in how these candidates respond?
Well, I think, to be frank, a lot of times, you know, media organizations are holding debates because they bring in a certain kind of audience. You know, they want to have people watching their station. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they are trying to hit policy positions or substantive issues the way that some people would prefer. There have been a number of attempts in the last few years to try and shake up the debate process. There was a famous one where there was a Democratic presidential forum in the 2008 campaign, and there were questions coming from YouTube. YouTube was one of the media sponsors of the debate. And so one of the voters, well, at least they said he was a voter, was dressed up as a snowman. And he asked a question to the Democratic candidates for president of the United States about climate change while dressed as a snowman.
Hello, Democratic candidates. I've been growing concerned that global warming, the single most important issue to the snowmen of this country, is being neglected.
One of the things that the debate tradition does is exposes, you know, the unguarded self. You get asked a question you're not prepared for. You don't have a talking point for it. Kind of exposing the human frailties. Here's a famous example.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third, sorry, oops.
I mean, that really was the Rick Perry's blown it moment.
And you could see, I was actually not watching the debate when that happened, but I was following it on Twitter, and you could see the tweets were, not that tweets can be catastrophic, but the reaction on social media from sort of the movers and shakers in the National Press Corps was, that's it, his campaign is literally over. And he did stay in the race for a while afterwards, but never quite recovered. And it still comes up even now that he's running again here in the 2016 campaign.
And it's moments like that that have made some of these presidential campaigns ripe for parody. Let's remember some of the famous parodies of presidential debates.
Rather than squander the surplus on a risky tax cut for the wealthy, I would put it in what I call a lockbox.
Governor Bush, your response.
I don't know what that was all about. But I will tell you this, don't mess with Texas.
Senator Palin, address your position on global warming and whether or not you think it's man-made or not.
Gwen, we don't know if this climate change, whoosie, what's it, is man-made or if it's just a natural part of the end of days.
Yeah, debates are great fodder for satirists. Saturday Night Live has had not only Sarah Palin's imitation by Tina Fey, but also Dana Carvey's impression of George H.W. Bush in the 1980s, which was originally much more cutting than it has become. There was the famous parody debate between Bush and Michael Dukakis, the Democratic nominee, and Dana Carvey as Bush creates this very long string of kind of half sentences, and then Dukakis, played by John Lovitz, just looks over and says, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
So debates are great entertainment, great for parody. But to summarize this real question, I mean, too many candidates means too much competition for the soundbite, the zinger, not enough substance. What do you say to that?
I would also add to that that there are concerns there are just too darn many debates. In the 2012 campaign, the Republican candidates were in 20 debates, including an evening debate in Manchester, New Hampshire, followed by a morning debate in Concord, New Hampshire, the very next day. So there have been a lot of efforts not only to winnow down how many candidates are in the events, but how often the events themselves take place. You can look at debates a lot of ways. You can look at debates as a way to learn about the candidates. You can look at debates as a way to look at how candidates relate to each other, what it might tell us about how they would perform in office. You can look at debates as a kind of entertainment, a sports kind of event for people who like to follow politics. It's always worth looking at what debates are and how they play out. What is important, I think, is to not assume that a debate is going to reveal anything that we don't already know about a candidate or a campaign, that it may just be an interesting chance for a candidate to either distinguish themselves positively or negatively.
So can we really get anything out of a debate if we've got 26 candidates standing across the stage?
We get a third agency that Rick Perry can't remember. We can get binders full of women. We can get Where's the Beef? We can get Reagan paying for this microphone. If nothing else, there's always zingers.
Brady Carlson, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks.
NHPR reporter, host, and author of the upcoming book, Dead Presidents, Brady Carlson. You can find his list of curated highlights from presidential debates at wordofmouthradio.org. With Donald Trump now in the race, the New York Times confirms the number of Republican presidential candidates at 12. That doesn't include the 11 declared candidates you've likely never heard of, nor probable candidates Scott Walker, Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal, and John Kasich. If they make it official, there will be 27 hopefuls vying for the GOP nomination. The crowded field has debate planners, party officials, and news teams scratching their heads, never mind the voters. Seth Maskett is political scientist at the University of Denver. In an article for Pacific Standard, he advocates for using a tried-and-true model for American competition, the reality TV show. Seth, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
So, Seth, you have some proposals for how we can winnow down the field of candidates from potentially 26 at this point, using some models that already work pretty well in American politics. I know some people have proposed doing American Idol-style voting for candidates. You're proposing a couple of other models, like The Voice.
Yeah, I thought something like The Voice would actually be a pretty good model for this. You could have maybe four quote-unquote judges at the front, like, say, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Rush Limbaugh, Sarah Palin, who are seated in rotating chairs, facing away. And then one by one, the candidates could come out, give maybe a 3 or 4 minute stump speech, and we see who turns around, who likes what they hear. And if no one turns around, well, they don't get to compete in the next debate. But if someone does, then they get coached by that person and maybe get into a little bit stronger position for the nomination.
Okay, what are some other reality TV shows that we could use as a model for our political process?
Well, I'm kind of a fan of the cooking show Chopped, where you have small groups of people who are given things that don't necessarily go together well, and we just sort of see what these candidates can actually produce of it. So maybe they're handed a bunch of random news clippings, something from the world of astrophysics or something from economics and something from entertainment. And we just see if they can produce a competent stump speech from all these things that somehow blame Obama or Hillary Clinton for everything.
These are great contenders so far, but I really love the idea for the kind of the real world approach. How would you stage that?
Well, I like the idea of, what a show like The Real World does well is that it puts a group of people together who don't necessarily get along that well and puts them in a lot of uncomfortable situations. So that seems perfect for this sort of thing. Maybe we could put all 17, 18, 25, however many candidates there are, make them all live together in a group house, maybe in Brooklyn.
And, in Williamsburg?
sure. Get them doing something like running a food truck or applying for Obamacare coverage or something like that, and just force them to collaborate in situations that are not comfortable for them and just see how they hold up.
I'm just imagining them all in really bushy beards and skinny jeans, which is good.
Exactly.
Well, all this sounds like it would be really fun to watch. But Seth, I mean, should this process be entertaining? I mean, should we get to eat our dessert and see these candidates before we get to eat the broccoli of, hearing their policy speeches?
Well, there are plenty of opportunities for us to get the substance from them. I mean, all of these candidates, or most of them anyway, have put together websites in which we can download some of their issue stances. We can watch plenty of very sober interviews with them. All the information we need is really out there. What the entertainment does is actually draw some people into the process. Right now, it's a fairly dry event so far, and it's also one that is fairly confusing and just doesn't interest a lot of people. I like the idea of at least trying to draw some more people into the process and, giving them a little better of an idea of just what's going on. And that's when you get the opportunity to hear them disagree about things that are actually substantive.
Well, in this case, we have Fox News and CNN saying that they're going to winnow down the field to have a manageable amount of candidates debating, or at least that's the plan. How is the field typically winnowed down?
Well, the debates do some of that. I mean, what really happens between, say, now and the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary is there's a winnowing that goes on outside of the debates. That is, all these candidates are trying to raise money. They're trying to get other politicians to endorse them. And some of them will be successful at that, and some of them just won't be able to get that support. And most of those people who don't get that support figure that out pretty quickly and just decide, I can't run. This year is not the year for me. And they drop out. But for those that stay in, you know, a lot of them will drop out once they realize they aren't winning any votes in some of those early contests. But we just haven't seen kind of this level of interest before in running for president, at least in the Republican Party. So I think it calls for maybe some innovative thinking about ways to winnow that field a bit.
Are there any benefits of having a massive field of candidates, do you think?
Well, it certainly allows for a wider range of views within the party. The Republican Party has been going through kind of an interesting simmering civil war over the last few years between sort of insiders and Tea Partiers and traditionalists and conservatives and moderates. And, you know, they are really kind of battling over just what it means to be a Republican. This is actually having lots of candidates allows a better airing of those issues and gives the party a real chance to decide just what it's going to stand for in the next 4 years.
Well, Seth, thank you for giving us something very entertaining to think about.
Well, thank you.
Seth Masket, political scientist at the University of Denver. You can find a link to read his article for Pacific Standard, The Republican Reality Show. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. When you think debate club, suit coats, ties, and Alex Keaton, earnestness may come to mind. But there's a completely new style of debate emerging on college campuses today, and it's attracting a fresh set of young voices. State of the Reunion and producer J.P. Davidson bring us the story.
When they're competing, traditional college policy debaters talk insanely fast.
First off, the criticism test is that classified a series of different groups under the banner of the press, why much small of them together, and do you want to make a margin whole thing?
That's the Kansas City team at the 2008 National Debate Championship. Apparently, the judges can actually follow what they're saying. For a long time, that machine gun pace was the standard for college debate. But when people like Davon Love got involved, everything changed.
I mean, I thought debate was like two podiums and people talking about trying to sound good about whatever, suits and ties, and, you know, trying to use a bigger word than the other person who spoke. You know, that's what I thought it was.
You really wouldn't think Davon would be a force for change in the debate world. He grew up in a not so great neighborhood in Baltimore, and he wasn't interested in school. Debate wasn't even on his radar. But one morning, when he was a sophomore in high school, he showed up early to school. It was cold out, and he needed an excuse to get into the building.
So I told the people at the front, I'm coming for debate practice.
And once he saw what debate was all about, he was kind of into it. Here were kids like him actually being listened to. Pretty soon he realized this could be his ticket into college. His parents couldn't afford it, so really, it might be his only chance.
So that was really my motivation. And so I just put a lot of energy into getting as good as I possibly could.
And Davon got good, really good. And he made it into college at Towson University. On the Towson debate team, he joined up with another ambitious African-American debater, Devin Cooper. They both had major problems with the usual way debate was being practiced. So they decided to stop following the standard machine gun style. They felt like it really stacked the deck against African-American students.
Because the research methodology and the pedagogy are such that it recreates the structures of society. You know, and our argument was that as college debaters, as scholars, it is our responsibility to orient our scholarship in such a way where one could be equipped to challenge the dynamics in society that cause the conditions that exist in aggrieved communities.
So Davon and Devin decided to join a movement that was trying to change the language of debate and add new weapons to its arsenal, like hip-hop.
I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro.
The team brought their new style to Nationals in 2008. They were competing at the highest level.
From Towson University, Devin Cooper and Davon Love.
To get started, they played a track by Baltimore spoken word artists Archie the Messenger and Lyrical the Lyricist. A pretty unorthodox move.
This is my pain on paper. This is my pain on paper. This is poetry. Now this is spoken word.
Spoken through open source, spoken through broken vocal cords. This is the prequel to the sequel. The anger of the unequal. This is the bleeds to a white tee. This is the peace sign to a t-shirt that says kill white tee. This is the cure to jungle fever. This is the video game that made the White House Resident Evil. This is my pain on paper.
And that track wasn't just for show. It was a key part of their argument.
We don't claim that you know, all black people are oppressed as individuals. Our argument is that the institutions that create the type of oppression that exists cause the type of psychological damage as well as being less able to access the means of power that Archie the Messenger talks about.
What they were saying was that the practices of the debate community perpetuate inequalities in society, and that these problems need to be fixed before they could have a really useful debate about something like U.S. foreign policy. That was actually the topic they were supposed to be tackling at the championship. But instead, they did their own thing. It was a long shot, so nobody was expecting this.
In the round between the affirmative from Towson, Devin Cooper and Davon Love, and the negative, Nate Johnson and Chris Stone, the decision is a 7-4 for the affirmative from Davon.
They won, and the fast talkers lost. It was big.
Oh, it was huge. I think that was the first time that an all-African-American team had won the national tournament, and then doing it in a style that endured so much backlash and hostility was really big. So it kind of set that particular style in stone as something that's going to continue in the community. They can't get rid of it. It's going to be there, and it's a force to be reckoned with.
That's Tiffany Dillard Knox. She's the acting director of the University of Louisville debate program. Louisville actually invented the new style that Davon and Devin used to win. Back in 2000, Louisville started working to recruit more African-American students. Debaters started blending their cultural identities with their arguments, and pretty soon a whole new way of delivering those arguments had evolved. And it's no surprise that the Towson team took on that new style. Devin Cooper actually got his start on the Louisville team before transferring back home to Baltimore. Not everyone was happy about the spread of the new style, though. Some traditional debaters were actually outraged to see their activity and their community start to change. And it was changing.
It's interesting that, you know, people talk about the style of debate, but it's more of a social movement, really, because we had to carve out a space for this style to even be acceptable. And it's still not fully accepted, but it's gained some traction, and it's more like a social movement that's beginning to snowball.
And that snowball just keeps growing. Davon is teaching high school debate now, and schools keep pushing debate in new directions. The style/movement has been around for over a decade now, and at Towson, students are still trying new things. Students like senior Benjamin Morgan.
This piece I wrote is called I Get Out. And it tries to explain, like, the relationship that I shared to the debate and trying to get out between the gap between my lived experiences and our words. So I say, I get out between the gap of explaining and resisting, enlisting and deserting a wall I stay missing. The from the corner whose mission to go to college position to be a scholar still relegated the squalor. The object of your oppression objectifies his conceptions in college to gain knowledge in white spaces he stepped in. Pac knock knock on the door but never let in. Fiasco, we let the get go. A little weapon against deceptions. Don't accept their misconceptions. The world was superimposed on my progression. Resolutions, solutions drenched in illusions. Delusions of institutions with slave blood running through them. Whiteness over black. Righteousness and crack. After I escape, they try to signify us back to human locations, can't put us on the map. I pull heaven from the sky to bring your world into trap. Heaven into hell was slavery to jail. You're framing me as prisoner, can't provide me bail. Your world is a jail and we're Jonathan Jackson. Death is inevitable and suicide is action.
Now high school urban debate leagues are joining the movement too. And that matters, because high school debate leads to college debate. And from college debate, why not politics? And from there, well, the potential is limitless. For State of the Reunion, I'm JP Davidson.
And here's a little postscript to that story. Davon Love is now Director of Research and Public Policy at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That's a grassroots think tank based in Baltimore, Maryland.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Rachel Dolezal, the fallen president of Spokane's NAACP chapter, has dominated this week's headlines after her parents told reporters that she has been lying about her race. Dolezal made her feelings known in an interview with the Today Show's Matt Lauer.
Are you an African-American woman?
I identify as Black.
The controversy has sparked a national conversation about the lived experience of race, self-identification, and who determines whether one is Black or white. While Rachel Dolezal's stridency is playing out in public, the question of racial identity is increasingly being hashed out behind closed doors in the doctor's office. Procedures that fall under what is called ethnic plastic surgery are on the rise. The American Society of Plastic Surgeons estimates that between 2005 and 2013, the number of cosmetic procedures performed on Asian Americans increased by 125%, Hispanics by 85%, and African Americans by 56%. Surgeries on Caucasians increased just 35% during the same time. Maureen O'Connor covered that rise in an article for New York Magazine called "Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield." So I'd like to start with those numbers that you cite in the article. What accounts for the dramatic and rapid rise in cosmetic procedures among the Asian Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics, especially in recent years?
Well, to some degree, it's probably sort of a catch-up process in that as minorities have, you know, bigger purchasing power, they have more ability to have luxury goods, and plastic surgery is essentially a luxury good in America. On top of that, there is sort of this huge boom in surgery, particularly overseas in Asia, and to some degree, some of the surgeries now occurring stateside are sort of mimicking or following that pattern, too.
What are some of the most commonly performed procedures or requested?
One of the big growth areas has been Asian blepharoplasty, which is the Asian double eyelid surgery, which is when some portion of Asians, not all, have what's called a monolid, which is when the skin on the eye goes straight basically in one plane from the brow to the lash line with no crease. So adding a crease or enlarging a very small crease is a procedure that is pretty much specific and unique to Asians because they are, for the most part, the people that have that type of eye. It's like getting an eye lift, but a little bit different and a little specific to the anatomy of the Asian eye to create that crease.
What are some of the other common procedures?
So under this term, ethnic plastic surgery, which has turned into sort of a surgical term of art now, that also includes things like what is known as an ethnic rhinoplasty, which whereas a traditional rhinoplasty on a Caucasian person will usually be a reduction, pulling down sort of a prominent nose or a hump in a nose by shaving it down or removing some. An ethnic rhinoplasty usually involves the insertion of an implant, which, and you'll see that on, for instance, like Asian people, sometimes African Americans or Latinos that have very low line, the bridge of their nose. And so a surgeon will raise the bridge and perhaps refine the tip, too.
So the sort of sculpted, more Michael Jackson-y look in the later years.
Well, I think that people are trying not to get the Michael Jackson look in particular anymore. But that is, I mean, that's sort of the rough, that's sort of what people associate with it, particularly people that haven't had or don't have familiarity with these surgeries. There's a very sort of negative stigma, in part because of people like Michael Jackson that have had very sort of notorious mess-ups and notorious sort of confusions that end up being racially charged when people look at them saying, are you trying to erase your ethnicity or change it?
But broadly, these procedures do make people look less ethnic, quote unquote, and that's actually the terminology that some of the plastic surgeons you spoke with. You know, they're kind of whiteifying features. And you spoke to some of the patients about their motivations. And what did you learn?
Well, you know, when I went into it, and particularly because they use that term ethnic plastic surgery, the assumption is that they're trying to remove some level of ethnicity. But 201, absolutely nobody said they wanted to look white. Everybody was sort of talking about modifying their features sort of incrementally, or they want to look like who they actually are, but with something changed. And so it's hard to ignore the fact that, for instance, you're changing this feature that is sort of endemic to Asians, say a monolid, and to say that must have to do with a white ideal. But on the other hand, there are plenty of surgeries that fall under this ethnic plastic surgery umbrella that actually have no Caucasian corollary or no Caucasian ideal connected to it, which, for instance, there's also a trend among the Asian American community of facial contouring, which would be a woman who takes, say, prominent cheekbones and pulls them in and softens them, or gets V-line surgery on her chin to sort of make this sort of small, dainty chin. And those are two things that actually fall under that umbrella and don't have a Caucasian corollary. So as I worked on this, my question sort of started to be, why are we so focused on these things that we can say, oh, that's westernizing? Why are we not willing to take these people at their word when they say it's not about looking white?
Mm. We're talking with Maureen O'Connor, who is a writer for New York Magazine, about the plasticity of race. There's been a huge increase in plastic surgeries among people of Asian American, Hispanic American, and African American descent, people who are changing their features to become, quote unquote, less ethnic or more Western. Or is it that? As we're learning from Maureen, it's a lot more complicated. So calling it ethnic plastic surgery may be an oversimplification or worse, or a completely racist assumption.
It is, and it's sort of one thing that shocked me as I was working on this was that we're so used to sort of this, in an age of political correctness, to hear somebody say, oh, well, that's a Caucasian feature, that one's very nice, or this is an Asian feature, I would give you plastic surgery on it, is almost blasphemous to the ear of somebody who's so used to extraordinary carefulness when we talk about race. And even that term ethnic plastic surgery sort of defies the common definition of ethnicity, which usually has to do with language and culture, and race, which usually has to includes physical appearance.
Mm.
And so there's sort of this sort of brashness to the way that people go forward with this, which is at one hand very shocking, but on the other hand a little bit freeing as well.
Let's hear an example here from September of last year. The TV personality, Julie Chen, she's one of the hosts of this show, The Talk. She revealed that she had undergone blepharoplasty on the show. Now, here she is explaining how it came about, a conversation with her agent.
And I want to show you a side-by-side of how dramatic this surgery really was. I mean, if you look at the after, the eyes are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I look more alert.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More expressive.
More expressive.
Right. And but how do you feel about yourself right now?
Now it's like I sometimes wonder. But I will say after I had that done, everything kind of the ball did roll for me.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I struggle with, wow. You know, did I give in to the man and do this? And it was...
Sorry, you didn't give in to the man, Julie. You know, because you don't know about giving in to the man. You know?
Fair enough. Right. I will say this.
Right. You didn't do that. You didn't do that. You didn't do that. You made a choice that was good for you. And you have represented, I'm going to say it, your people. You represented your race. You represented women and your colleagues. Don't look back.
Thank you.
So her co-host says, you know, you didn't give in to the man. But what was the response from the public, especially among Asian Americans?
You know, that just hearing that now, you notice the marked difference between the way the audience is reacting with gasps,
yes,
sort of shock,
uh-huh,
and then the way, you know, Sharon Osbourne saying, fabulous, as though she's discovered some, like, beautiful new shade of eyeshadow. The public... There was a lot more gasping in the public audience than there was among her co-hosts. We'll put it that way, that I think a lot of people saw that, and particularly because she told that story in the context of, I had a boss who said I couldn't be a news anchor because I looked too Chinese. I had an agent who told me he wouldn't take me on. She put it in sort of the world of racism, and I think that is the way a lot of people end up feeling and seeing these procedures. So a lot of people did say, yeah, you gave in to the man. You just said, this is the man, a TV honcho who tells you to get surgery, and you did it. On the other hand, she then did a follow-up where she said, I wasn't trying to erase my race. I don't think that's what this procedure does, which sort of demonstrates the sort of ambivalence that I think a lot of people have.
And a lot of the outrage on these westernizing elements of plastic surgery actually do come from white people. You know, these are the people who say, how could you possibly cave in to an agent who would say something like that? So are we putting too much of the onus for this on other ethnic groups?
You know, it is interesting that as I was working on this, all of a sudden I wondered why there's such a vested interest in policing what minorities do to body parts that we associate with their race, and to sort of feel like we need to police that an Asian person, these eyes we think make them look Asian, and thus they're not allowed to change them. And then I started wondering, where does that impulse come from? Why does that all of a sudden become everybody else's business because it's a body part that we associate with racial identity?
You yourself, Maureen, consulted a very famous plastic surgeon, you know, when you were working on this article. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are criticizing doctors who profit off of these procedures. Mm-hmm. Have these surgeries that are popular in other countries been more widely adopted by doctors in the U.S. in recent years?
They're certainly booming, definitely, here. One thing that one doctor pointed out to me was she said, well, when you look at the photos of and the types of surgeries people get, say, in Korea versus the things that Korean Americans or Asian Americans get, it's much more extreme overseas. And to some degree, that's probably because the medical laws and practices are just more loose out there. To another degree, though, what she suggested was she said, well, maybe it's that over here, an Asian person would see all the variety of all different peoples of different races every day, and you get used to sort of thinking that you're altering your face to fit in among a very diverse crowd. And then some of that is the sort of shocking frankness of people who choose to look at beauty and faces as something that can be chosen from among the features of all the peoples in the world, and there's something sort of almost comfortingly, almost post-racial about it in some strange way, to be totally sort of freed from all of the baggage associated with that and to just say, well, these are the features that you want to change. I'm going to change them for you without any bringing in the political implications every single time.
Well, you think, you know, you could say, I want Jessica Alba's nose or Kim Kardashian's bottom, you know. There is this kind of commodification about it that still feels a little creepy, you know, that you can just build yourself or even breed a child to look a particular way.
It's very, it felt very much like science fiction sometimes, although the question is this a dystopia or a utopia? It's sort of alarming in many ways to hear people talking about race and ethnicity with such sort of freeness as though you can sort of pick and choose pieces of it.
Maureen O'Connor, I want to thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maureen O'Connor is a writer for New York Magazine, and you'll find a link to read her article, Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield, at wordofmouthradio.org. Cosmetic surgery may be problematic for race and identity, but it's like gravy when it comes to good material for jokes. From Kathy Griffin to Chris Rock, comedians routinely poke fun at those who get work done. Here's a short collection of stand-up comics taking on plastic surgery.
I would never get plastic surgery, clearly. But I don't understand it. I don't, especially when it becomes recreational and repetitive. Women do it all the time to look younger. And it would make perfect sense if one of them ever came out looking younger. Men get it too, not as much, but they do. I read a story about one guy that got a lot of plastic surgery and he's in his late 70s. Getting plastic surgery in your late 70s, it's kind of like painting your house as the fire approaches.
Michael Jackson going to jail. It's gonna be a sad sight when Michael Jackson go to jail. Oh, we gonna shed a tear when Michael Jackson go to jail. And it ain't even gonna be sad the day he go in. It's gonna be sad like a month later when that perm grows out of his hair so he don't got the Crayola people to fix his face no more.
Okay, now can we talk about
Heidi Montag?
Oh my gosh.
Go.
All right. First of all, it should be on the Discovery Channel because she is the first human to have a successful entire head transplant. Entire head transplant. This isn't dental work.
Makes no sense. I understand liposuction. They mess that up, you can put a shirt on. There's no shirt for your face. Dude, if you're thinking about getting a facelift, do yourself a favor. Just wait it out. Let them practice on other people's faces. When they work it out, then you go in. It's like hair plugs. Hair plugs don't look half bad, no. Saw a guy in a commercial the other night, he's like, ah, God, I wish I did this 10 years ago. It's like, no, you don't. 10 years ago, when they were stapling ant legs to the top of people's heads, everybody's eyes watering, trying not to look at your hairline. Dude, you gotta be happy with who you are, man. There's nothing wrong with being 45 and looking 45. Would you rather be 45 and look 45 or be 45 and look like a 28-year-old lizard? You know, that's basically your options.
Comedians Kathy Griffin, Bill Burr, Chris Rock, and Dana Gould there, making hay out of the pitfalls of plastic surgery. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review and pass it on or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth right here on NHPR.